With our special guest tonight, Robert Sarmast, as we talk about Atlantis on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast with our special guest, Robert Sarmast. Robert, I had always heard that the Garden of Eden was by the Euphrates and the Tigris rivers.
Well, I believe that, well, you know, keep in mind that Adam and Eve were driven out of the garden. They were banished from the garden. So just right there, you have to take into, you know, consideration that they had at least two homes, don't you think?
Yes, that's a good point.
They were someplace, okay. And they went someplace else. What we're looking at is the original home, the first home before they were driven from the garden. And I do believe we found it. Just getting back to your other question quickly about what we found. You know, when the book was published, we saw the rectangular valley. I could barely make out this low mountain that was in the middle of this valley, which matched the description of the Acropolis Hill, its size, location, everything was perfect. And even though there are hundreds of mountains, underwater mountains in the area, I pointed to that one and that one alone. And I put its exact coordinates in the book, and I said, this is where the remains of Atlantis are going to be found. Then I came to Cyprus after I talked to you last time, and we did an expedition about a year later, and we developed some maps and models of the area. And sure enough, on that hill and nowhere else, we found a gigantic wall that runs ruler straight for 2 miles before it makes a sudden right-hand turn. And it seems to be encompassing this hillside territory, complete with canals and river paths that are coming off the summit. So on top of the 50 matches that I had with Plato's description when the book was published, now we had another dozen or so with real sonar data that we gathered, allowing us to see the seafloor for the first time. It's just impossible that all these are coincidental. And, yeah, we have found structures down at the depths which match the description of Atlantis perfectly.
Now, how come the mainstream, I know we had the big push 2 years ago, but I'm not hearing a lot about it anymore. How come?
Because I think mostly, you know, we just had a sci-fi documentary made on it. We're organizing a second expedition. There are dozens of people involved. I mean, it is going ahead. But the problem right now, George, is that the scientific world has its head stuck in the sand. And, you know, for the first couple of years, it really kind of ticked me off. But I've begun to understand that this is not up to science. Science and scientists are involved with things they can smell, touch, and feel.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, science can't go forward unless it has tangible facts that it can smell. So the people that are pushing the envelope, the people that have to go and make these discoveries, are going outside what is considered accepted fact. And so you have these scientists, which, you know, to my mind, in a lot of ways, they're just as crystallized as religionists. You know, and dogmatic in what they believe, that are just sitting around and saying, well, no, Atlantis doesn't exist. Plato just made the whole thing up. Well, what the hell are you talking about? You're saying that Plato, one of the greatest geniuses in the world, and Solon, the father of democracy, and the Egyptian priest, and the entire ancient world was just kidding? All their religions, their ceremonies and rituals, their architectural motifs, everything they believed in was just false? Now, even that I could accept. But, you know, we don't know today where civilization started. We don't know. The oldest one we know of that could be considered as a real civilization was Sumeria, which is only 5,000 or 6,000 years ago.
Right.
Nobody knows where these Sumerians came from. We don't know where the first alphabet started. We don't know where agriculture started. We don't know how it went about. We don't have a place where there were only 5 letters of the alphabet, and then they turned to 10 and 15 and 20. All of a sudden, Sumerians appear out of nowhere with a fully developed culture. Now, scientists, on one hand, are saying that we don't know where civilization started. And on the other hand, they're completely rejecting what the entire ancient world said was a fact. And they're saying, no, they don't know what they're talking about. And on top of that, they don't even bother to look. That's not science. You don't come to a conclusion without testing. The science means you form a hypothesis, then you test it, then you come to a conclusion. So at least in a scientific way, you have to say, maybe, since the entire ancient world believed in this thing, maybe it did exist. What's so crazy about an island going underwater?
Absolutely.
It happens all the time.
Well, I was going to say, it appears that there are a number of regions on this planet where land masses have gone under. We talk about off the coast of Egypt, what Alexandria used to be. They're now saying that hundreds, if not thousands of feet out, they're finding things. It appears that Mother Earth has gobbled up a lot of landmass, hasn't it?
Absolutely. You know, all the tectonic plates are constantly shifting. And, of course, that's especially true in the Mediterranean, which is one of the most geologically active areas in the world, particularly when you take into account the fact of the flood coming through the Strait of Gibraltar and doing what it did. I mean, this place, being an island in the Mediterranean, is something like being a sock in a washing machine. You're constantly going up, you're going down, the water level's going up, the basin itself is sinking, is rising. This place is a geological hotspot. Things happen all the time here.
Edgar Cayce, who has had some incredible predictions of his prophetic readings when he was alive, claims a lot of things. Earth changes, he thinks there's a hall of records at the base of the Sphinx. But he also believed that Atlantis was in the Bimini Islands in the Bahamas. I assume you think he was wrong, but maybe there were land masses there, huh?
Well, there could have been, of course. Yeah, I do think he was wrong about that. You know, psychics can't be right all the time. And, of course, a lot of people believe that it was in the Atlantic because of what it says in Plato's text.
Mm-hmm.
It specifically says that it was in the Atlantic. But
how did they know it wasn't called the Atlantic then, was it?
It wasn't called. The previous name was the Sea of Atlas. And, you know, reading Plato's Critias and trying to find this island is a little bit, or actually a lot, like a detective story, where it seems like, you know, there's this guy, let's say he's a criminal, and it seems like he's the one who committed the crime. On the surface. But then you do a DNA test, and everything points away from this guy and to somebody else. So on the surface, if you look at it, well, it's, you know, in the critics, it says it was in the Atlantic. Well, there you go. But if you read the rest of it, 99% of the Critias gives you details about this island, the animal life, the weather patterns, the kinds of metals that were on the island, the types of food, the location, the exact look of the island. When you actually read that part of it, you come to the realization that it couldn't have been in the Atlantic. And I'll give you three simple facts that in themselves should point anybody towards the Mediterranean.
All right.
Just simple logic. We're told that the Atlanteans, when they became wicked, were having a war with the Athenians in the eastern Mediterranean. And right there, Plato says that there was this giant earthquake, and all of these armies were, quote-unquote, swallowed up by the earth, okay? And then while this happened, it says, at the same time, Atlantis was, in a similar manner, swallowed up by the sea. So this earthquake happened in the eastern Mediterranean, and it says, at the same time, Atlantis went underwater. Are you telling me that an earthquake in the eastern Mediterranean sunk an island in 8,000 miles away in Bimini, and that there were people around that knew this? What they do, call each other 20,000 years ago and let each other know? It's not possible. That's number one. Number two, we know that Atlantis was where civilization was supposed to have started. The
right.
Egyptians told Solon that both the Greek and the Egyptian civilizations were offshoots of this original archetypal
mm-hmm.
civilization. We know for a fact that the cradle of civilization is the Near East. So what? Civilization started off the coast of Florida and left no remnants and then suddenly reappeared 10,000 miles away in the Near East? Number three, I mean, I could go on and on, but, you know, the story comes from the eastern Mediterranean. This is where it all came from, the Egyptians and the Greeks. This is where the Garden of Eden, all those biblical accounts took place. This is where the gods and goddesses were supposed to live.
I thought Atlantis was bigger than what I see here.
That's due to another surface read of Plato's text, where it says, you know, it was larger than Libya and Asia put together. So, well, in your mind, you say, well, it had to be bigger than Libya and Asia. Let's see, Asia is so big, Libya is so big. All right, but the people that actually saw this island and wrote about it couldn't have possibly mentioned Libya, since there was certainly no country named Libya 20,000 years ago.
True.
And they, of course, would not have known how big Asia was, and they wouldn't have used the word Asia. I mean, even in Plato's time, thousands of years after the island supposedly went underwater, they only knew a little bit of Asia. I mean, they knew a little bit of Southern Europe, a little bit of Near East, a little bit of Northern Africa, and that's about it. And they believe that this little landmass surrounding the Mediterranean was surrounded by a gigantic body of water. I mean, if you look at a map of what the Greeks in Plato's time thought the quote-unquote world consisted of, it's a joke. Now you project that another 10,000 years before Plato's time and think about what these people who had to, you know, just to get over a river, they had to bundle some reeds together, tie it together somehow, and you know, get on top of it and swim across. I mean, this, you're talking about very, very ancient, primitive times, where if you traveled 100 miles without getting skinned alive, it would have been a miracle. What did these people know about geography? Are you telling me that they said, well, let's see, Asia is this? They didn't have satellites back then. They didn't know what Asia was, how big it was. They didn't know where the continents were. They were completely in the dark. So you have to keep those things into account. And when you inspect it in detail and you give it that DNA test, things start to unravel. The surface stuff suddenly completely vanishes, and you're left with hard physical data about what this island looked like, its physical features, and the other clues, the metals, where the plane was, where the mountains were, that kind of thing. And that's what I concentrated on.
Now, Robert, did the island sink, or did the water just go up, go high?
It was a combined effect, because what happened when the flood came in and filled up the Mediterranean basin, you're talking about a gigantic volume of water which comes into this basin. And, you know, if you take that weight into consideration, that, of course, would have pushed down on the basin, pushed down on the mantle, and the entire Mediterranean basin would have actually
dropped.
Yeah. In combination of the rising water level of all this ocean water filling up the Mediterranean. And that's what it says in Plato's text, is that when, you know, these fighting armies were swallowed up by the earth, and it says Atlantis was swallowed up in a like manner. So it was combined, and of course it would have taken a long time, but those people that were living on that valley at the foothills would have gotten a pummeling.
I assume at the same time then, Egypt lost some of its landmass. I mean, it's right in that same region.
Well, yeah, I mean, it would have been, most of the people would have been, remember, Mediterranean Basin is like a scar on the face of the earth,
yeah.
So you have this massive drop. But yeah, the Nile Delta, you can see that it still goes down, and you can still see its remains on the seafloor of the Mediterranean a mile below. So most of the people and a lot of those cities and civilizations, as primitive as they were, would have been living down there, and they're long gone. But I knew early on when I started the research and getting the expedition together that the only chance of finding anything man-made down there after a flood like that, after the tremendous geological activity, would be the gigantic structures that are described belonging to the Acropolis Hill in the middle of that valley. So I concentrated on that. And because it's on the eastern end of Cyprus and the flood would have come from the west, I sort of guessed that, well, most of the island would have blocked that massive rush of water. And there is a chance that maybe something is still existing around this hill, which we could see on those early maps. And then we went there, and it's there. It's still there. It's this gigantic wall, 300 feet thick, 2 miles long, ruler straight. You have canals. You have river paths coming off the summit. Even the distance of this canal wall at the base of the mountain to the summit itself is exactly 1.5 miles, the precise measurement that Plato gave us. This cannot be coincidental.
Tell me about the equipment you used to verify some of these theories.
We conducted what is the world's most scientific Atlantis expedition in history. And this was in November 2004. It was done by some of the best underwater specialists in the world. Phoenix International, and EDT here in Cyprus. These are some of the guys that work on the Titanic all the time and with James Cameron and so forth. We used a ship with a side-scan sonar, which is a very sophisticated deep water sonar unit that gets lowered to the depths and gets dragged by a cable behind the ship. And we fly it about 50 feet above the seabed. And the ship zigzags across a certain area, and the sonar collects data, which shoots back up through that cable to the computers on the ship, and we get a sonar-generated image. So we're looking at the seafloor live while we're going over it. And we saw this wall that, you know, all these scientists were saying it couldn't be there from the earlier maps. You know, when we developed the maps after the book was published, we got our hands on some new data that the French had collected on an unrelated expedition. And that's the first time that we saw this wall making this 90-degree turn on the canals, which was astonishing because it was just on that hill that I put the coordinates for. There's hundreds of mountains there, and there's nothing else around those mountains, and it just happens to be on this one mountain that I pointed to before we could even see it up close. And the scientists, when they saw that map, they said, oh, that can't be there. There has to be something wrong with your data. Because it's striking. You know, you don't have ruler straight 2-mile-long walls that are consistent. This wall is also consistently 35 feet high throughout its course. And they said, no, it can't be there. There has to be something, because it's so astonishing. They couldn't believe it. So we did our own expedition. We used an even better, more sophisticated type of sonar, and we went, and it is there. So we have two independently gathered data sets showing the exact same thing. There's no doubt that it is there. And, you know, the proof is there. If you go to discoveryofatlantis.com, you can see the sonar images that we created using the latest technology available in the world. We published an expanded edition of the book just a few months ago with all the pictures and the story of the expedition and the sonar images. You can see the whole thing in the book there. And, you know, at this point, the scientists suddenly that were so skeptical around the world suddenly they're not around anymore. They're not saying anything because they don't have an explanation.
I was going to say, you had, you know, a couple of years ago, you had what, the French geologist and there was a German physicist. Both of them were kind of vocal with their own theories. What happened to them? They fade away?
Well, they faded away. One of them was saying that, oh, this mountain that you found with all these physical, you know, anomalies is just an underwater volcano. But you know, it's just incredible what some of these so-called scientists will come up with, you know, these professional skeptics. There's no such thing as a rectangular, craterless volcano.
No.
It doesn't exist.
I don't think so.
They're trying to explain this thing away that can't be explained away. And another guy was saying, well, maybe it's just a mudslide. You don't have a mudslide that leaves no footprint, that leaves no trail. There's just this wall sticking out like a sore thumb in the middle of nowhere, with nothing else like it anywhere in the vicinity, exactly where I put the coordinates for and said that this is the place where the remains of Atlantis City will be found.
Do they even acknowledge the fact that there are, you know, artifacts or structures down there?
Well, they don't have an explanation for this structure, certainly. They don't. There is no explanation for it. It has to be man-made. You don't have a massive wall 35 feet high, going ruler straight for 2 miles, and then making a 90-degree angle in the middle of nowhere, 50 miles out.
If you were to see this same structure, let's say, on Mars, like, you know, Richard C. Hoagland sees when he interprets pictures, he wants to chat with you. He's very excited about your work, by the way. One would have to deduce that they were man-made, because nature just doesn't do that.
Exactly. And you know, there'd be reason to doubt if, let's say, you were looking at an area and there were all these markings, there were all these walls zigzagging all over the place, and one of them happened to be straight. You say, well, this one, you know, some geological freak.
Exactly.
We don't have that. We developed a map of that entire area with hundreds of underwater mountains. There is nothing. It's just hills and smooth surface seafloor, just mud. And just on that one hill, you have this thing that's absolutely shocking.
Well,
did it come from?
Even if they didn't agree with you that that's where Atlantis was, why can't they at least agree with you that something sank, Robert?
Well, they know the Mediterranean sank. I mean, there's actually, they haven't even done testing for that. You got to remember, geophysics is a very new science. You know, it's in this era of infancy. And just 30 years ago, if you told scientists that the Mediterranean used to be an empty basin that was flooded through the Gibraltar, maybe, you know, they would have laughed at you. They would have said that's not possible, but it's been proven. So this is something that's going on, and more evidence is coming in. A lot of the reasons why the scientists, matter of fact, we sort of rejected this at first, is that they said, well, we've done some core sample testing of the seafloor, on the Mediterranean seafloor, and we found that the flood must have happened around 5 million years ago.
Jeez. Well, stay with us, Robert. We're going to be right back with you on Coast to Coast AM. Well, tomorrow night for you StreamLink members, we will have our Coast to Coast chat. That'll be at, 8 o'clock Pacific time. I'm in so many time zones these days, I don't know what time I'll be there. No, it's 8 o'clock Pacific time, and we will do our StreamLink chat. So make sure you're part of the program on Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. We're going to take your phone calls next hour with our special guest, Robert Sarmast, who is live in Cyprus. You've been out there how long now, Robert?
2.5 years.
God. And the research continues?
The research continues. We did the expedition. We got our sonar results. Now we're going to do a second expedition because that wall is covered by mud, as you'd expect.
Sure.
Being down there for so long, what we want to do is use what's called a sub-bottom profiler, which is a more focused type of a sonar unit that can penetrate the silt and actually generate images of what's under it. Now, if it's rock, let's say, whatever it's made of, if it's not mud, and I don't think that's mud, whatever it is, it's man-made. There's no doubt about that in my mind and millions of people around the world, and we're going to prove it with this next expedition.
Would you have structures there like we have in Greece, the Acropolis, for example? Is that possible, or is that really too far back?
No, there are whole cities down there, George. This rectangular valley is where civilization started. There are tons and tons of artifacts down there. But because it's deep sea, because the Eastern Mediterranean seafloor sank and the water level rose,
yes.
You're talking about a mile of water. And unfortunately, most people don't know this, but radar doesn't penetrate water. So the only way we can even see what's down there is by using sonar, which entails a costly ship and the equipment and the specialists. So the money factor is always a problem. And because science has decided that no, Atlantis doesn't exist and we don't even need to look for it, then it becomes a stumbling block for us. But we're surrounded with a bunch of very good people. We do need funding for the next expedition, and we're working on that. And we need help. You know, this is something that can change the world. And, there are tons of artifacts there, and I think for the next several decades, as underwater technology improves and as we have more and more ability to not only look down there but to retrieve things, they're going to bring up just – it's a living museum down there, and it's going to astonish the human race.
And there could be millions and millions of skeletons down there, too, don't you think?
There are. It's just a matter. I mean, I think that this is going to continue for a long, long time to come. And I'm very excited about the new technology as it develops. But right now, it's just the cost is very prohibitive.
Cyprus itself, which is part then, as you say, of Atlantis, when was it named Cyprus? How did it get its name? Do you know? I don't.
I don't know when Cyprus got its name, but, it's a pretty ancient place. They have Neolithic remains here that I've seen myself that are 8,000 years old. I mean, there is no end to the archaeological remains here, and of course, it's going to continue. Every once in a while you hear about something else they found. But, of course, the area that we're specifically interested in is about a mile underwater, which is where the people would have been living. So where we're living right now, the current form of Cyprus would have been a mountaintop to those ancient people. And because of the geological structure of Cyprus, this thing just shoots up straight out of the seafloor. It actually, the whole island formed due to two tectonic plates clashing and one of them buckling under and the other one rising up. So Cyprus itself is a very fascinating geological structure. It's an ophiolite structure, which means that the even its highest point, which is called Mount Olympus, believe it or not, used to be on the seafloor. But this is, the island itself is chock full of mythology. This is the center of the world. This is where Aphrodite supposedly rose from the water. I mean, you can go to the place, it's called Aphrodite's Rock. It's about a half hour from where I live right now, where she supposedly came. The mountaintop is called Mount Olympus. Cypriot mythology itself says that the gods of Atlantis used to live to the south of the island.
I bet.
Adonis and Aphrodite supposedly roamed around here. I mean, there's no shortage of mythology, their own historical accounts that say it all happened right here, and we're just confirming what they've been saying all along.
That landmass before it sank must have been gorgeous. I'm sure it had beaches and everything else.
It did, and the beaches here are still phenomenal. I mean, there's some beaches here, there's some formations here that if you look at them, I mean, you really get the impression that this place must have been Atlantis. It's absolutely stunning. It's a gorgeous, gorgeous place. Clear water, beautiful weather. They even found elephant remains in Cyprus, you know, because Plato said in the Critias that there were elephants in Atlantis, which is very strange because how would elephants get to an island? And they found elephant, pygmy elephant remains in Cyprus, which is another source of mystery for them because they said, well, how did these elephants get here?
I would have thought maybe Asia, when they could have walked over at that time, huh?
Well, yeah, but currently scientists say that Cyprus has been an island for millions of years. So how did they, you know what the science, quote-unquote scientific explanation is of these, of how these elephants got to Cyprus?
No,
it's
huh?
Ludicrous.
Not, don't tell me they swam.
Yeah. So a whole herd of elephants
decided
to just swim into the open sea and go 60 miles and reach here in mass. I mean, it's ludicrous. But when we lowered the water level, you can see that land bridge. It was connected to Syria. They simply just walked over this land bridge. Not a big deal.
It's interesting, too, how close it is to the region where all this fighting is occurring right now. Relatively close.
It's a hot spot, that's for sure. You know, this Lebanon conflict has complicated a lot of things for us in regards to the second expedition.
Well, how is Cyprus in terms of safety? Man, they used to have problems a long time ago, didn't they? I always
about
used to
30
hear
years
about,
ago, they yeah. had a, there was a short war here with the Turks.
Greeks, and the Turks and the Greeks, right?
Yeah, yeah. So the island is sort of divided. It has Nicosia, its capital, is the only capital in the world right now that has a wall running straight down the middle. And the Turks control the northern, I would say, third of the island. And there's a UN buffer zone, and the Greeks live to the southern portion of the island. But it's very peaceful here. The people are very friendly. It's a beautiful, beautiful place. And we don't experience the conflict that's just maybe 100 miles from us. We don't really experience that here. Of course, the evacuees are coming here en masse, but most of that's already over and they've gone back home.
Do you believe that the Book of Urantia, which is an incredible book all to itself, also talks about extraterrestrials and visitations, doesn't it?
Absolutely.
Do you believe that portion of it?
Absolutely.
You do? Okay. So,
I do. But, you know, these are not the extraterrestrials. These are not the little green men with antennas coming out of their heads. These are beings that are very much superior to us and very altruistic and very loving. They've come to the realization that the universe is a structured place with, you know, a mechanism, a series of laws, and they abide by them. And you know, this whole bad rap that extraterrestrials have in our world right now, where they're out to get us or take our gold or eat us, or it's just nonsense. If, you know, we've only been around for a few thousand years, or even let's say half a million or a million years, in the big scheme of things, in a universe that's practically infinite and ageless, that's nothing. That's not even a blink of an eye. If there are civilizations, if there are worlds out there that have life, and if they started even just a little bit before us, they would still be so much more advanced than we are that it would boggle the mind. Look, 100 years ago, going to the moon was considered ridiculous. Now we're going to the Mars. Just imagine where we'll be 100 years from now. that 100 years in this universe is nothing. So the likelihood of there being beings that are out there, you know, inhabiting other worlds and being much more advanced and intelligent than us is not a, a long shot. It's almost a certainty.
What's the next trip then for you in terms of funding? What can you do if you had a blank check?
Well, you know, I've taken this, it's been a personal mission. It's been an excruciatingly challenging and rewarding adventure. I wouldn't give it up for anything. But realistically, this should not be done by me at this point. This should be done by our top universities, by our top specialists, with the massive funding that it needs. But as it is, science can't go forward without facts. And there's a sort of a line in the sand that they can't cross. So I can't really blame them. But on the other hand, you know, when I look at the magnitude of this discovery and what it means for the human race, for just, let's say, less than $100,000, we could take this to a finish. If you're our listeners, each one contributed a dime, we get this thing done. But we do need help. If people come to the website, if you buy the book or donate or whatever, we need that. We need people to help us. This is huge. This can change history, because all of these problems right now in this world with these crystallized religions, you know, Islam and Christianity and Judaism and so forth, they're all stuck in their sacred scriptures that we know are faulty.
We've got a lot of people who want to talk with you. The phones are starting to ring now. Robert, Richard C. Hoagland, our science advisor, very excited about your work. He's on the line with us now, too. Go ahead, Richard. I know you had a couple questions for Robert.
Yeah, first of all, Robert, I want to tell you what an honor it is to talk to you. I've been following your work for a couple of years, and I think you're a real pioneer. I agree with everything you're saying about academia, except for the last part. I think it's a disgrace that academia doesn't get involved. An absolute disgrace, because they're really such cowards that they will not dare, in this era of publish or perish, to venture one micron beyond the accepted tautology. And you are doing cutting edge work, and you should be supported. So I have a present for you. I may have some people who have some funds to help you do what you need to do. So you need to ask George or Tom how to get hold of me. We need to have a conversation privately. No promises, but there could be some people who will be very supportive of what you're trying to accomplish.
Oh, thank you so much, Richard. That's great news, and we always welcome people that want to come along and help. And, you know, we have some amazing people helping us. This has been going on for years and years. We estimate, you know, millions of dollars have been spent on this if we think of the time that the people have put in. But this is an expensive project, and yes, you're right, it is a disgrace to science that they're sort of have their head in the sand. I try not to think about it, but yeah, you're right, you know, and people in our circles consider at least certain parts of the scientific world as modern day shamans.
Well, you know, when I look back at my career going all the way back to Cronkite, I was able to use other sources of funding to do innovative science. It's kind of been my pattern, so let's see if we can do it again, because you are doing something that is at the cutting edge and needs to be supported, and we'll just do it without them, and then, of course, they'll all come running and claim that they knew it all along. You know, that's what usually happens.
Yeah, that's right.
Now,
that's,
let me give you one quick present here before I have to go.
Sure.
George doesn't even know this. He's dying to know what I have as a present for you. I have a colleague named David Flynn, who's been on Coast a couple, three times. He's going to be at my Joshua Tree conference in October. David is a kind of an exoarchaeologist in the fundamentalist Christian community, and has been looking very heavily at the Middle East, particularly Syria, Lebanon, Israel, et cetera, et cetera. And he and I have come up with some remarkable evidence that indicates, George, that the transposition of our great-great-great-great-great-great-grandmothers from Sidonia came to that part of the planet. Specifically, Mount Hermon is involved. The Baalbek Valley, Baalbek, which is now the center of this incredible new crisis, it's all part of this equation. It's all part of this exquisite puzzle, Robert. And when you talk about Critias and how these guys came from the heavens. My colleague and I may have a point of origin for these guys, and I will predict that if we can get you the funds to go down and bring up things, artifacts, if we can find libraries, we are going to perhaps, George, be able to put together the missing link between Earth and Mars.
Well, that would be exciting.
Wouldn't that be that phenomenal?
That would be exciting.
Phenomenal, and it's science, it's testable, and all we got to do, Robert, is get you some money. That should be the most trivial part of this.
Yeah, and, you know, in the big scheme of things, when you think about what you know, money is wasted on and what this can do for rewriting human history and adding to our knowledge of our, you know, of our history, of where we come from, it's nothing.
So
it's less than $100,000. We can take it to a finish.
As Joan Rivers used to say, we need to talk.
Richard, why do you think that the mainstream scientists don't even want to listen to the theory?
I believe there is a terror under all of this that all the history we think we know is absolutely wrong. And so many careers, George, so many livelihoods, so many reputations, so many egos are fastened to what we read in our texts of the last 6,000 years, that when someone like Robert or myself comes along and has some other ideas, you know, it's almost like they have to stone us to death to keep their worldview static and their employment assured.
When you look at his maps, his Mediterranean baseline maps, you could see exactly the outline of what very well could have been that island.
Oh, no, 12,000 some years ago. That's why I've been looking at this for the last 2 years. And what he doesn't know, and no one has known in this audience except they know it now, is that, you know, David and I have been working on where the refugees may have come and where those biblical, you know, legends, text, archetypal ideas, iconic ideas, Genesis 6, the whole Nephilim scenario that Mike Heiser and I debated vigorously with David at the Wisconsin conference. All of that comes together, and when I saw Robert's work 2 years ago, I said, bingo, he's got to have it because he doesn't know the other clues, and it's kind of like a double blind.
Yeah.
It's kind of like when he went to the Urantia book, which you would never in a million years think would have data. Robert, you got to follow the data, and you're doing exactly what you should be doing, and so let's see if we can help you, and give me a call, you know, sometime in the next few days, and let's see if I can put you in touch with some interested people.
All right,
you bet.
We'll
I
get
sure
the contact
will.
Thank
for you
so
Richard.
Much.
Thanks, Richard.
My pleasure.
Appreciate it. He's always Richard C. Hoagland. He thinks out of the box like you do, Robert. And you have to do that on these kinds of theories.
You do, and you know it's not that out of the box. I think most of what the mainstream scientific academic world believes is not that logical. You know, when I was in school, and there's this sort of aura of fatalism that permeates the so-called academic world that disgusted me when I was in my university years.
Yeah.
There's this sort of feeling that we can't know. You know, and I was just a young man at the time. What do you mean, we can't know? You know, it's just their attitude is leave well enough alone. We already know everything that's going to be found, you know, that there is to know, and it's already settled. No, we don't know anything. We don't know where civilization started. We don't know anything about the missing link. We don't know tons and tons of the most important questions that the human race faces. We don't have answers for, and I don't accept this fatalistic outlook, and, you know, that's the attitude that I took in my life. I said, I can know, and I will know, and I just followed what is true science. You form a hypothesis, which is, hey, at least maybe this place existed. Why don't we take a look? And I created the maps, we created the software, brought it down, brought the water level down, and sure enough, it is there. This is true science. Not sitting back on your armchair and saying, oh, we can't know. Oh, Plato was just joking around, and that's it. Goodbye. That's not science.
Well, I tell you what, if you find some pyramids down there, then you're really up to something.
Absolutely, and I think once we use these special equipment, you know, we have the technology now. We're the first generation in history that has technological ability to not only map the seafloor, but to bring core samples up, to look under the mud, see what lays under. We have the ability. It's just a matter of people come along, like Richard, like you and others, to come along, help us, and get this done. I have the expedition formed. I know where the equipment is. Everything is done, ready to go. And we're right on that edge now where I think we can, not only in this lifetime, but in the next few years, to bring this discovery to the forefront and create the waves that are needed to take this, you know, give it momentum and take it all the way.
All right, Robert, you ready for some phone calls?
Sure.
Stay with us. We'll be back in a moment. Your turn on Coast to Coast AM.